There's further controversy over TDs' voting habits this morning. Three more TDs, including the Housing Minister, Owen Murphy, have said they were in the chamber but not in their seats when their votes were recorded earlier this year. The other two are Fine Gael Minister of State, Damien English, and Fianna Fáil's Barry Cowan. You'll recall the controversy began when it emerged that the Fianna Fáil TD, Niall Collins, had voted six times for his absent colleague, Timmy Dooley. For more, we can talk to our political correspondent, Micheál Lehane. Micheál, the list grows. What can you tell us?
There has been an extensive trawl through the voting records of all TDs going back over a year now, kind of in the last 48 hours, and things are beginning to come clear. We do know now there is a widespread practice of TDs voting for colleagues if they are in the chamber. Ministers admitting that yesterday. Something else happens too on occasion where politicians press the wrong button, but they say they correct the record of the Dáil with the clerks after that. But some other questions, of course, were more fundamental, and they dated back to last Thursday and what transpired there. But in recent times, there is examples of TDs voting, but you can't see them on the camera angles within the Dáil chamber. They included Barry Cowan, Damien English, Minister for Housing Owen Murphy, and also the Minister for Community and Rural Affairs, Michael Ring. Now, all of them are adamant that they are at the back of the chamber when this happens and that there is evidence to suggest this. Owen Murphy says his ministerial folder is there when this relevant vote was taken last January, and you can see it and it's never out of his sight when he's in the Dáil chamber. Michael Ring too saying he attends all votes and that he is talking to a colleague at the back of the chamber, Barry Cowan, saying that he has never in his life asked anyone to vote for him if he's not there. Damien English, stemming from a vote last May, says the same thing, and he's checked his diary and he is in the chamber at that time. So we can see the focus really on the voting system within the Dáil. That is going to continue and it's going to be in the spotlight. The next step, I suppose, is the publication when it happens of the Ceann Comhairle's report, which is just looking at last Thursday. You'd expect that the Dáil Business Committee may be updated on that today, perhaps a short statement in the chamber. We're not certain of that yet. And then that ultimately one would expect would make its way to the Committee on Procedures and Privileges, possibly later this week. And then the big question, will there be moves to radically reform how TDs vote in the Dáil, and indeed senators in the Senate as well?
I suppose, Micheál, the big question for many people listening this morning is why, if you're in the chamber, why don't you just go to your seat and vote?
A lot of business seems to be conducted during that voting time in the chamber. It's an opportunity for TDs to talk to ministers. There are conversations that take place there because they may not otherwise have an opportunity to meet them and get, because this can go on for a long time. If you look at the voting blocks as they take place on a Thursday, they can run over a 35 to 40 minute period or even longer. It is an opportunity to speak, and that seems to be what happens. There's also ministers taking calls, walking up to the back of the chamber where there aren't any camera angles. There are four ways in and out of the chamber, and the business of government continues during that point. That seems to be the defence that's being put forward.
So what's your sense then of where this goes from here?
I think suddenly the entire system is under scrutiny. I think the most scrutiny, though, will remain on the Fianna Fáil TDs, Niall Collins and Timmy Dooley last Thursday, and they, of course, the focus of the Ceann Comhairle's investigation. But I think you are working your way towards a big change, whether that's an identity card around the voting system or whether it's even fingerprint technology. Probably in the short term, to keep the spotlight on this over the next few days, you will see the Dáil reverting to the system it had before 2002, where you had walk-through votes, where there is absolutely no doubt about who's voting on what issue when they have to walk up through the lobbies and have their name ticked.
Now, in another matter, as we heard in the news bulletin, Simon Harris due to bring legislation on vaping to the Cabinet today. What can people expect?
Yeah, there have been a lot of calls within the Dáil for the last few months to act in this area, and this will make it illegal to sell e-cigarettes to under 18s. It's also going to end the sale of tobacco from vending machines, and indeed an entire new licensing system around the sale of tobacco and nicotine inhaling products, which is what you'd call e-cigarettes. That's going to be put in place. So retailers from now on will have to apply annually and pay a fee for a license to sell them. Also, people under 18 won't be able to sell these products, and events that are organised for children, tobacco won't be permitted there either. It's going to be backed by enforcement orders, we understand, which will include fixed penalty notices and the publication of the names of offending retailers.
Micheál, thanks indeed. Micheál Lehane there, our political correspondent.
Cowan's phantom vote for Brexit law. That's the Irish Independence front page lead headline, which manages to combine the two big stories of the day. The continuing struggle by the British Prime Minister to get his withdrawal agreement bill through the House of Commons, and the controversy here over voting procedures in the Dáil. A letter writer in the Irish Times also connects the two. Maybe Boris Johnson should consult Timmy Dooley and Niall Collins on how to get the Brexit vote over the line, writes Colm O'Faherty from Rathgar, Dublin. The Independent reports that Fianna Fáil public expenditure spokesman Barry Cowan is the latest frontbench TD to be dragged into the growing storm over so-called phantom voting. As the paper says, his vote was recorded on a Brexit law and on two other pieces of legislation last month, where he appeared to be absent from the chamber and other TDs sat in his seat. Last night, the Independent reports Mr. Cowan insisted that he never asked a colleague to vote for him when he was not in the chamber. The Irish Examiner's lead headline adds the name of Damien English, junior housing minister, to the controversy. The minister told the paper he was at the back of the chamber on a day last May when his voting button was pressed during a vote on the Greyhound Bill, but was not in his seat. He too said he had never asked anyone to vote for him when he was not present. The Times adds more names of TDs from Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin who have admitted to voting for colleagues who were in the Dáil chamber but not in their designated seats. Votes in Westminster are the subject of the lead story in the Times. Dennis Staunton writes that Boris Johnson faces a nail-biting vote today as he attempts to rush legislation for his Brexit deal through Parliament at breakneck speed so that the UK can leave the EU by the 31st of October. Leo Varadkar's part in helping Johnson get his deal from Europe is noted in a column in The Examiner by Fergus Finlay. I think it needs to be said loud and clear, writes Finlay. Our Taoiseach did a great job for his country last week. His decision to fly to England and meet Boris Johnson on his own patch was a masterpiece of tactics and timing. And it's absolutely clear that he persuaded Johnson to accept some bottom lines. As Finlay puts it, Varadkar has nailed Johnson to a form of Brexit that's about as good as we could expect. Meanwhile, from the north, the Belfast Telegraph reports Geoffrey Donaldson of the DUP as warning Boris Johnson that his party might not return to Stormont if unions don't get a veto on future Brexit arrangements for Northern Ireland. The return of the Northern Assembly yesterday in an effort, unsuccessful as it turned out, to prevent changes to the law on abortion provides the Irish News lead story. The paper reports that in a statement, the Northern Ireland bishop said it was deeply offensive to dismiss yesterday's sitting as a stunt. They said the attempt by pro-life politicians to recall the Assembly was an issue of fundamental importance. The Irish Daily Star's lead story is devoted to Terry Mullarney, a young Mayo woman who waived her anonymity yesterday so that her stepfather, Thomas Mullarney, could be named for the crime of having abused her for 12 years. He has been sentenced to 12 years in prison. The Irish Daily Mirror reports that Jennifer Zamparelli, 2FM radio presenter, has spoken about how she was beaten up by bullies every day in primary school in Dublin. Mary Robinson, former president and now special United Nations envoy on climate, provides the main story for the Irish Daily Mail. Asked about the Extinction Rebellion protests around the world, she said, "I hope they will be very smart about their tactics, because if they alienate the public, that will put us a step backwards." Speaking to reporters in Armenia, Mrs. Robinson said that climate protests were one way of causing disruption, but that the most effective method was through investors, asset managers and pension funds.
Abortion has been decriminalised from midnight last night in Northern Ireland, despite a last-minute attempt by unionists to block the change. The measure brought in by the UK Parliament at Westminster could have been blocked by the Stormont Assembly, but efforts to hold a sitting yesterday failed. The Northern Ireland office says it will bring forward new regulations for termination of pregnancy in the north by the 31st of March next year. In the meantime, it says there are no plans for additional abortion services services to be routinely available. But former Northern Ireland Police Ombudsman Baroness Nuala O'Loan says the change has opened the way for a radical and unregulated abortion law being imposed on Northern Ireland. Baroness O'Loan joins us on the line now. A very good morning to you and thanks for taking our call.
Good morning.
What are your concerns about this change in the law?
Well, effectively what has happened is that there's a complete decriminalisation of abortion. And in that context, we have no regulation because we had no abortion law. So the normal process is you pass a law and then you produce regulations and you consult before they pass the law. So you have a process that enables you to, in some way, be prepared for what you're putting on your people when the time comes. That didn't happen. So, for example, the government has said they don't anticipate that there will be abortions conducted. Don't anticipate is not legislative language. And they talk about serious, but there will be a discretion in cases of serious or fatal fetal abnormalities. Well, there's no medical definition of fatal fetal abnormalities, and I recall one very, very sad case in Dublin where a couple were told that their baby would not survive, and after having an abortion, they found that the baby was, there was nothing wrong with the child. So we don't, we don't have the processes around that. We certainly have no definition of what a serious fetal abnormality might be in the eyes of the government. So we don't know where they're anticipating that there might be more abortions, but it's not against the law now to have more abortions.
That's
the first thing.
All right.
And then the early abortions. We have no process for the provision of the morning after pill. Probably, I don't know, about 90% of abortions in England and Wales are using the morning after pill.
On the key question of decriminalisation, which is what the law has changed.
Yes.
That means, does it not, that a woman, for example, who takes an abortion pill in Northern Ireland, she can't be prosecuted. She can go to her GP. The GP doesn't have to report her to the police. Now, are you against that change?
No, I'm not. But I'm against a change that says there's no care for her. She can go to her GP, but the GPs in England and Wales, GPs don't prescribe morning after pills. So there's no process for it. It's not just a pill. I know that the pro-choice people will say you just take two tablets and that's it. But it actually is a serious medical intervention, and there's no process as there is in England and Wales for caring for the patient. So we don't have that. We don't have any counselling services arranged specifically for abortion. We don't actually have any funding allocated
surgery. How does criminalising a woman in that situation address any of those concerns?
It has never been an objection in my head that I'd never wanted that women would be criminalised. I've just said that. I think it's important that that those who provide abortions should be regulated, and that there should be some limits on abortion. As it stands now, it's possible to get an abortion in Northern Ireland up to 28 weeks or earlier if the baby is viable. But 28 weeks is what the law presumes, cause whatsoever.
Where does 28
and
weeks?
You can get that abortion anywhere.
Where does 28 weeks come from?
Although the government don't anticipate that the NHS will provide abortions, private enterprises could provide abortions.
Where does 28 weeks come from?
28 weeks comes from the Criminal Justice Act 1945, which is the one which criminalises abortion, the Criminal Justice Act 1945, which says that it's an offence to take the life of a baby which is capable of being born alive, and then the next the subsection says that the presumption is that a baby is capable of being born alive at 28 weeks. But that's a rebuttable presumption. So if a baby, we all know that babies survive to 22 weeks, but it will be an individual assessment of the life of the particular baby.
This is now to be worked out over the next several months.
Yes.
Presumably there's an opportunity here that if the Stormont Assembly can reassemble, then Northern Ireland's elected representatives can have an influence, can even take control of what eventually emerges.
No, because the regulations will be passed in Westminster, and the way that it's done is there will be a consultation, but they actually will be drafted by the Northern Ireland office for the minister, and they cannot be challenged once they're placed on the table of the House, so that once they're placed, that's it. They'll be passed by the Westminster Parliament. So there's no process for amendment of them or anything. What we will have is a consultation period. Mm-hmm. I mean, what about, you know, the child who seeks, the 14, 15-year-old who seeks a morning after pill, and medical confidentiality applies, and her parents don't know she's taken such medication? Mm-hmm. What if she becomes ill? There are just 1,000 questions it's going to be managed.
And Baroness Newell alone, there we leave it. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us. We'll be talking a little later in the programme to some of those who welcome this change in Northern Ireland last night. It's just gone 25 past seven.
Report led by research at University College Dublin shows that 2/5 of parents give treats such as chocolate when children ask for them. 12% of parents say they give treats at least once a day. The report is part of an awareness campaign being run by Safe Food, which promotes safe and healthy eating. We'll be hearing more in a moment. First, though, our reporter Amy Nirida has been speaking to some parents.
I don't find it hard, but it's very difficult to control it. You give them some tips when they work in the house, or kind of, you know, thanking them, so you're not there, and they still use the same money to buy sweets. So it's uncontrollable, kind of. You can't really say no.
So it's more of a reward system?
Yeah.
Do you find it challenging to say no to your kids when they ask you for treats?
I don't say no, because if I don't give it to them, who will?
How many would you give them in a day?
It depends on how much you have.
We wouldn't keep sugary sweets in our house. We only have the oats ones without sugar. At parties, they get cake with sugar in it, yeah. I mean, you have to be strict.
Do you think maybe it takes a hero to say no to their kids in relation to treats?
Yes, because they love, especially this one. She loves sweets, so she can eat that when since morning to evening.
How many treats would they get every day?
Sometimes one, sometimes zero. That depends. How they good they are.
100.
Every day is different. It's work with them. If they do good and they do homework and everything what they ask them, they always get some surprise. It's not always sweet, but surprise.
And what do you say to Mom when she gives you treats?
Thank you.
Parents and one younger voice there speaking to our reporter Amy Nirida. Aileen McGloin of Safe Food is with us in studio. How do you classify a treat? What's a treat?
A treat is a food that's high in sugar, fat and salt and doesn't provide a whole lot of nutrition. These are very familiar foods, crisps, biscuits, chocolate, sweets, cake and so on. So
but not an apple or an orange?
Definitely not.
And what has the research found then about parents' attitudes towards treats?
Well, we've known for quite a while that treats make up quite a large proportion of children's diet, about 20%, 1/5 of a child's diet, and they're the second most consumed group. What we really didn't know until this point was why parents give treats. Many of the parents there mentioned giving treats as a reward. They give them because the child asks, and they give them because children simply ask for them. But underpinning all of this, I suppose, is this ubiquitous treating environment. So everywhere that a parent goes, they nearly find treats unavoidable. If they go to pay for petrol, they have to lean over a sea of confectionery. If they go into a supermarket, they're bombarded with special offers. If they go into somebody else's house, their child is almost guaranteed to be offered a treat. So they find this extremely challenging. And I suppose another part of that is this treating culture that has grown up. So because treating is such a norm, it's almost impossible to swim against the tide of treats, if you like, and, you know, stand up and say no to treats. And that's why we're saying parents really have to be heroes to do this.
As you say yourself, though, at this time of year, especially because of Halloween and Christmas, we'll say yes, in a low voice, the shops are just coming down with treats. They're just tables of stuff everywhere. It's very hard to avoid them.
It's really hard, and we're not so concerned about these annual events where treats, you know, it's okay to have treats at Halloween, it's okay to have treats at Christmas, but every day is Halloween. You know, we're having them after school, we're having them after tea because we ate our dinner, and obviously on the weekends as well. So it's this very habitual treating that we're really targeting, and we very much want to acknowledge that this is extremely challenging for parents, and that this moment of saying no is a where parents feel under extreme pressure and that they really have to be strong and even brave to say no to treats in this kind of environment.
Because it is hard, isn't it? And many parents as well, they can feel guilty about an awful lot of things as it is. So is there a danger here that you're just going to add to the burden?
Yeah, we absolutely do not want to blame parents, and clearly they're not to blame. There's a whole environment out there that is, I suppose, pushing them towards this treating behaviour. So instead of that, we really want to support parents and encourage them. And we have loads of information on our website, makeastart.ie, that will help them with that particular moment, with making plans, with getting support from others, because it's not just parents, there are others in the child's environment that are also giving treats. So we really just want to be here as an ally to parents in this very difficult moment.
Aileen McGloin, thank you very much for joining us on Morning Ireland. It's 7:30.
Your first look at the business headlines this Tuesday morning. Here's Petula.
Thanks, Brian. On PUSS, gender pay gap in favour of men is 3.7% compared to 13.9% nationally. The company puts the pay discrepancy down to a gender imbalance at management level. It's publishing its first gender pay gap report and action plan at the GPO today. New research carried out by Tourism Ireland has found that a growing number of people in Britain are booking their holidays later and will take fewer short breaks than normal in the next 12 months because of Brexit. The Brexit effect is also seeping into continental Europe. 17% of people in Germany and 13% of people in France said they were less likely to visit Ireland because of the hassle post-Brexit. In good news for tourism, Galway has been named the fourth best city in the world to visit in 2020 by Lonely Planet. The travel media company described Galway as brilliantly bohemian. The accolade comes as the city prepares for its year as European Capital of Culture. Taking a look at the currencies, 1 euro buys 86 pence sterling and $1 11.5 cents.
And joining us this morning is John Murray.
Good morning to you, Rachel. A surprise defeat for Arsenal in the English Premier League last night. They went down 1-0 to Sheffield United at Bramall Lane. 23-year-old former French under-21 international Lys Mousset scored after half an hour in United's first win at home in the league in 2 months. They move up to ninth. Good news for Mick McCarthy too. Republic of Ireland striker David McGoldrick returned from injury and played 78 minutes. Sheffield United manager Chris Wilder.
To host a game like this, the magnitude of it, and to play well and get a win, yeah, we were under enormous pressure second half, but I think we're limiting them to few chances. And, you know, we backed up a good performance with a good result, and we didn't four or five weeks ago against the European champions. And we wanted to make sure if we played well against the top sides, you have to get something from the game. And, you know, we've got some talented boys that have been on the journey from League One, and now they're playing the trade in the Premier League, and Arsenal at home and winning. It's, as I said, not the biggest result in the club's history, but it's a fantastic one and great reward for everybody connected to the football club, because it's been quite a difficult journey getting to here.
So Arsenal miss a chance to go third, losing only their second game of the season. Their manager, Unai Emery.
I think we didn't deserve to lose. And also, I think only we conceded a lot of corner in the first half today, and they scored their goal in one action, but can happen. And another, when we have our possibility to attack, our possibility to get their balls, I think we created better and more chances than them, but we didn't score today.
Liverpool's Champions League winners dominate the nominations for the Ballon d'Or after seven of Jurgen Klopp's men were included on the 30-man shortlist announced last night. In all, 15 Premier League-based players were named alongside five times winners Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi. Also in soccer last night, Millwall appointed former Stoke and Derby boss Gary Rowett as their new manager. He replaces Neil Harris, who had been in charge at the Den for over 4 years. Manchester United have launched an investigation after a spectator was ejected from Old Trafford amid allegations of racist abuse during the game against Liverpool on Sunday. United have branded any form of racism as completely unacceptable. The Champions League resumes tonight. Spurs play host to Red Star Belgrade, while Manchester City are at home to Atalanta. In Gaelic games, Clare GAA have announced that the two nominees to be the next Clare hurling manager are former hurler of the year and two-time All-Ireland winner Brian Lowen and Louis Mulqueen, who was in Davy Fitzgerald's backroom team in the 2013 2013 All-Ireland success. To rugby news now, and referee Jaco Pieper was not considered for a World Cup semi-final appointment after an inappropriate picture of him with Welsh fans appeared on social media. The picture shows South African official Pieper mocking the elbow to the head that earned France lock Sebastian Vahamahina a red card against quarter-final opponents Wales on Sunday. Vahamahina has since announced his retirement from international rugby. In a statement, the governing body said World Rugby can confirm that the match officials selection committee did not consider Pieper for selection this weekend. Pieper recognises that a picture of him with Wales fans, which appeared on social media after the Wales versus France quarter final, was inappropriate and he has apologised. Welshman Nigel Owens will take charge of England against the All Blacks, while France's Jerome Garcés will officiate at the Wales versus South Africa semi-final. Cardiff Blues wing Owen Lane, meanwhile, has been called into Wales World Cup squad as a replacement for injured back row forward Josh Navidi. The 21-year-old made his test debut during Wales World Cup warm-up games, scoring a try against Ireland in Cardiff. There's racing today at the Curragh. The first is off at 1. For sports news updates during the day, you can check out the RTE News Now app and RTE.ie.
The Liberal Party of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has retained power in a general election, but he'll lead a minority government depending on the support of smaller left-wing parties. Mr. Trudeau, who took power in 2013 promising sunny ways, saw his popularity decline over the handling of corruption controversies and the emergence of old photographs of him in blackface. As the results came in, he addressed supporters in Montreal.
From coast to coast to coast, tonight Canadians rejected division and negativity. They rejected cuts and austerity, and they voted in favour of a progressive agenda and strong action on climate change. I have heard you, my friends. You are sending our Liberal team back to work, back to Ottawa with a clear mandate. We will make life more affordable. We will continue to fight climate change. We will get guns off our streets, and we will keep investing in Canadians.
Outgoing and incoming Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. We can speak to Janice Dickinson, a reporter with the Globe and Mail newspaper. But she's based in Vancouver and is on the line now. Very good morning to you, Janice, and thanks for taking late at night for you, I think, this call.
Yeah.
So what's the latest with the results that are coming in?
Yeah, so as your clip played and your intro was dead on, Mr. Trudeau survived. He has secured a minority government in the House of Commons. So he will, you know, have to rely heavily on the New Democratic Party and the Bloc Québécois, another party, for support when it comes to passing bills and legislation. And I think we're in for some pretty interesting times here ahead.
And is it clear at this stage it will be a minority government, or is there any suggestion that they could bring some of these smaller parties into a coalition?
Well, I think we're going to have to wait and see until tomorrow morning to see sort of how things unfold between the Liberals and the New Democrats. That's sort of the most obvious pairing that would work together. But my sense is that the Liberals will likely try and, you know, they'll form government, they'll push on, and it will likely be a bill-by-bill situation, relying heavily on NDP support.
It's quite a come-down for the Liberals and for Mr. Trudeau personally, given this huge mandate that he got in 2015.
It is, and it really is rare, because in Canadian history, typically when a party gets a majority government, when a leader is extremely popular, they're often given another majority, and you know, Canadians typically have a lot of faith in their leaders and are very generous with their support. So this is upsetting for the Liberals, but I know that they were you know, happy tonight to at least form government.
And is it some of the his handling, at least, of some of the corruption allegations and scandals that have swirled around the government, has that been the thing that's delivered the biggest hit? Are Canadians feeling, in terms of their economic situation, reasonably good? What's been going on that's delivered this?
Well, I think that the the SNC-Lavalin scandal. I'm not sure if it made its way to Ireland, but it was certainly one that contributed to months and months of negative stories for the Liberals. As you mentioned earlier in the campaign, photos surfaced of Mr. Trudeau in blackface. That was also a big hit and I think a major shock for Canadians. And I think that people were sort of thinking that maybe Mr. Trudeau wasn't holding others to the same bar that he sets for himself.
All right. Well, as you say, an interesting couple of days ahead and weeks, perhaps, as they involve themselves in this process of negotiation to form a government. But there we leave it. Janet Dixon, thanks very much indeed for talking to us. Here on Maureen Ireland, it's 7:45.
To those revised plans to overhaul Dublin's bus network, more details are due to be announced later today after 50,000 people contributed to the first round of public consultation. It's understood that the National Transport Authority has agreed to a substantial increase in the number of bus routes. Our Dublin correspondent John Kilrain is on the line. John, this process has been underway for quite a while. Can you remind us how it began and where we're at now?
Well, last July, the National Transport Authority unveiled this new bus design. It had been drawn up by an international US-based consultant, Jared Walker. And his point was that the Dublin bus service was very confusing. There was a lot of overlapping routes and there was a lack of orbital routes. People, you know, having to go into the city centre and travel out again to get to a neighbouring suburb. So he drew up this plan. It was based on 7 spines travelling across the city through the city centre, and there'd be 11 orbital routes and a number of local routes as well. But it would mean that some people would lose direct access into the city centre, that have to interchange or to take 2 buses to get into the city centre.
Now, the NTA received a huge number of submissions. What, as far as you know, were the main issues raised?
Well, they received 50,000 submissions. That's 30,000 actual submissions and 20,000 signatories, which is a record as far as anyone can see for any type of, certainly public transport consultation in Dublin. Mm-hmm. The interchange was a big one. I'm out in Lusk today. They were going to lose their direct bus service into town. They'd have to interchange at Swords underneath the plan. There was also a problem with local access to schools, universities, shopping centres, hospitals, areas like that. Areas like Beaumont and Wadley were particularly exercised about these type of access problems. And also there was concern about the elderly and disabled people. They might have to walk extra distances to get to bus routes. The plan was criticised by the NBRU, the bus union. Also a number of left-wing groups were concerned that this was a prelude to privatisation. So there was a huge amount of opposition in a number of different Dublin suburbs to these plans.
As you understand it then, what's likely to be announced today?
Well, it seems, according to what we've been able to hear, that what the NTA are going to unveil is a 22% increase in bus routes overall. The main points being a new spine. So there'll be an 8th spine added, the spine, a H spine. They're done in letters from A to H. That will go along the Howth Road and allow greater connectivity to Malahide, Portmarnock and Howth. Areas like Dunboyne and Lusk, which were going to lose their direct service into town, for instance, Dunboyne would have to interchange at Blanchardstown, they're going to get these new peak time services, which will offer them direct access into the city centre during the peak morning and evening rush hour. But it seems off-peak they might still have to do an interchange. And generally there's going to be a lot more local access, and some of the routes that were going to have lower frequency, their frequency for direct connections into the city centre, like in Chapel Lizard, is going to be increased.
When are all of these changes due to come into effect?
Well, first of all, there has to be a second round of public consultation. This latest plan now will go out again, so people will have another opportunity to give their views on this plan. And then when that's passed, sometime in the new year, they'll begin rolling them out. It won't be a big bang change. It'll be a gradual incremental change with different bus routes introduced on the different spines. And that is due to take up until 2022. The other part of Bus Connects, which involves structural changes to 16 bus corridors, that would involve felling of trees and compulsory purchase of some garden areas and more bus lanes. That project won't be ready for public consultation until January.
Okay, so we won't be hearing any more about that today?
No.
John, thanks indeed for joining us. John Kilrain there, our Dublin correspondent.
Galway has been named the fourth best city in the world to visit in 2020 by Lonely Planet. The travel media company described Galway as brilliantly bohemian. The accolade comes as the city prepares for its year as European Capital of Culture. Niall Gibbons, CEO of Tourism Ireland, is here. Niall, this is great timing for Galway. Does Lonely Planet get a helpful nudge to consider destinations like Galway, particularly when Galway 2020 is coming up next year?
Well, Lonely Planet have their best series that comes out every year this time of the year, and it's great to have, you know, something Irish in there. So this is really good news for us. I mean, they have a huge global spread and a very good international brand with a really good reputation. So to have an Irish city in the top 10, not the first time by any means. I think we've been up there for about five times in the last 6 years. But particularly with European Capital of Culture, it's a great nudge for Galway, a great plan for Ireland now in terms of marketing abroad for 2020.
Tourism Ireland did get advance notice of this accolade, and you've a campaign ready to go to leverage it.
Indeed, yeah, we have a new video highlighting Galway and the whole programme for 2020. We've got extensive social media work as well going on with our 5 million fans around the globe. There's 23 million unique visitors coming into Ireland.com as well. And throughout all our channels over the next months as well, we've 22,000 international media who will be targeting some of them to visit Galway during the course of the year.
Okay. Now, will the campaign show that regional airports are closer to Galway than Dublin? You'll be familiar with the Copenhagen Economics Report that highlighted Dublin Airport's dominance at the expense of the regions, and it was supported by Galway Chamber. What's your view on that?
Well, we're working very closely with the regional airports, and it was announced in the budget that there will be an additional fund over the coming 3 years to work with the airports and airlines to try and deliver new additional routes, because certainly point-to-point into the regions is something we want to achieve much more of over the coming years.
Now, being named fourth best city in the world to visit next year, is it tangible? I mean, will hotels, will restaurants notice the Lonely Planet effect?
Well, I was down in Galway twice over the last sort of couple of weeks, and I think the tangible impact of Galway 2020 is very, very visible. I think the team down there put together a super programme, and it really puts us in a very strong position as we head into the booking cycle now for 2020 and the months ahead.
Now, that's the good news. The bad news for tourism is Brexit. The industry is reporting lower numbers of British tourists this year. The Brexit effect is also seeping into continental Europe. What did your surveys find?
Well, we've been dealing with Brexit now for nearly 3.5 years, and we have a Great Britain-based Brexit task force, which just carried out five waves of research in Great Britain with Red Sea Polling Company and two cycles of research in France and Germany. What we're finding is that the Brexit story is now starting to spread amongst mainland Europe, with about 13% of French visitors and 15% of Germans thinking of taking an alternative destination than Ireland next year, generally caused by the level of uncertainty that's there and the hassle factor. There's a lot of choice out there at the moment. People can go lots of destinations, but for us the clock goes back to zero on the 1st of January, and we have to do it all again with a different audience. So it isn't good news for us. We did pick this signal up earlier on during the year, but it's becoming more pronounced as the year has gone on, and as the uncertainty feeds into consumers' minds, it certainly has the capacity to impact significantly on the tourism season for 2020.
And the hassle factor, what are they talking about there? I mean, nothing's going to change for a French person visiting Ireland post-Brexit as it would today if they're arriving this coming weekend.
And that's a message that's not easy to get through in the fog of all the mainstream news. I mean, there's a lot of perceptions and noise that people are picking up generally about Ireland, about Northern Ireland. So, for example, 17% of Germans thinking of changing their holiday next year, but 25% of people thinking of not going to Northern Ireland. And it's important in a world where Tourism Ireland has been marketing the island of Ireland abroad for the last 20 years that we continue to get that all-island message out there. For example, two-thirds of all visitors who come from mainland Europe and North America coming to Northern Ireland come via the Republic of Ireland. So we're fully interdependent, and we have to make sure the consumers get the message out there that there isn't any hassle factor when you come here. It's very much business as usual.
Is Tourism Ireland looking at other markets because of this?
Well, very much so. We have been looking over the last number of years to diversify our markets, particularly into Asia as well. But that doesn't come without its risks as well. We have seen the Hainan services from Beijing and Shenzhen, and also the Cathay Pacific service in Hong Kong postponed over the winter. So an awful lot of work to be done. And certainly North America looks like the most promising promising prospect for 2020 right now. But we can't give up on these other markets as well. We're very pleased that the government has voted an additional €6 million into the Tourism Ireland Fund for activities to reassure our customers towards the end of this year. And there is a €40 million no-deal Brexit contingency as well that we hope we don't have to use, but it will be well used if we have to.
Right. Niall Gibbon, CEO of Tourism Ireland, thank you very much for coming in to us this morning. I'll have more business news at 8.30, but for now, back to you, Rachel.
Let's go now to Met Éireann. We're joined from there this morning by Siobhan Ryan.
Thanks, Rachel, and a very good morning now from Met Éireann. Well, many areas staying dry once again today, outside of a few light showers in the west. However, it will be a little bit cloudier than recent days. Highest temperatures 10 to 13. That's in a mostly moderate southwest breeze, which will be fresher up along the Atlantic coast. And holding mostly dry tonight now with variable cloud cover. However, later in the night, rain will begin to edge into Atlantic fringes. Lowest temperatures, 3 to 9 degrees, coldest in the east. Now, we'll be wet and breezy across Atlantic coastal counties tomorrow morning, while starting out largely dry elsewhere with some sunny breaks. However, outbreaks of rain will very gradually become more widespread into the afternoon and for a time in the evening, at which point they will clear eastwards into the Irish Sea. Highest temperatures tomorrow then, 11 to 13, and that's in a very fresh and gusty southerly breeze. Now after that, Thursday looks set to be blustery or windy with sunshine and scattered heavy showers, most of those affecting the northern half of the country, generally dry and calm after dark but turning cold with overnight lows of minus 1 to plus 3. And after that then, Friday looks set to be cold and calm to begin with scattered falls of rain. Actually, some very heavy persistent falls are likely in over the Midlands, south and east, with the likelihood of spot flooding. And it will become breezy at times too, mainly near coasts. Then for the bank holiday weekend, well, it is an uncertain outlook at this stage. At the moment, however, indications point towards cool, bright, calm weather, but very cold after dark with widespread frosts. Today then, in brief, many areas staying dry for the day, but there will be a few light showers, generally in the west, but overall it will be cloudier than recent days with afternoon highs of 10 to 13. That's in a mostly moderate southwest breeze, which will be fresher up along the Atlantic coast. That's all for me for the moment. A very good morning.
It's 8 o'clock. The news is read by Brian Jennings.
Abortion has been decriminalised in Northern Ireland. The British government introduced new laws at midnight that also enable same-sex marriage after politicians at Stormont failed in a last-ditch effort to block the move. Our Northern correspondent, Vincent Kearney.
For the past 52 years, abortion law in Northern Ireland was much more strict than the rest of the UK. As a result, hundreds of women travelled to England every year to terminate pregnancies. But MPs at Westminster passed a bill in July, compelling the British government to change the law, unless power sharing at Stormont was restored by midnight. Unionists yesterday tried to thwart the move by forcing through legislation at a special sitting of the Assembly. That could only happen with cross-community support from nationalists, and Sinn Féin and the SDLP both withheld support, so the new law came into effect this morning. Apart from exceptional circumstances, it will be April next year before women can have abortions in Northern Ireland, but they can now seek and receive advice from health professionals about terminations without fear of criminal prosecution. Under the Westminster legislation, marriage between couples of the same sex and civil partnerships for opposite-sex couples will be lawful from the 13th of January. Vincent Kearney, RT News, Belfast.
The state is expected to offer a formal apology today for failures in the cervical check service to women and families affected. The Taoiseach Leo Varadkar is due to address the issue in the Dáil this afternoon. Our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
Over 1,000 women and families have been affected by the cervical check crisis. The failures first came to light in April last year with the settlement in the Vicky Phelan High Court case. The screening service failed to tell women their original slides had been reviewed and that some women may have benefited from earlier care. Today the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar will offer an acknowledgement and apology on behalf of the state. The 221 Plus group representing many of the women has said this will be a significant day. They will closely analyse the content and delivery of the apology. Key members of the group, Vicky Phelan, Stephen Teep and Lorraine Walsh, will be in the Dáil chamber to hear the Taoiseach speak. The 221 group has said its desire is that the apology will help bring some healing to those impacted and mark a turning point in the state's approach on the issue.
MPs at Westminster have been set a three-day timetable to put Boris Johnson's Brexit agreement into law. The British Prime Minister hopes to get enough support for the legislation so that the UK can leave the EU with a deal by the October 31st deadline. MPs only received the text of the complex withdrawal agreement bill last night. From London, Dimitri O'Donnell reports.
Boris Johnson's latest strategy is to ram the entire legislation through the House of Commons in just 3 days. The timeframe is extremely tight to pass a new law and get it through all its common stages by Thursday. Over the next 2 days, MPs will debate the withdrawal agreement bill in late-night sittings. On Thursday, the government hopes to hold a crucial vote to deliver Brexit. Opposition MPs say there is not enough time to scrutinise the complex 110-page Brexit bill. Dimitri O'Donnell, RTE News, London.
The Minister for Health, Simon Harris, will bring legislation to Cabinet today to ban the sale of e-cigarettes to those aged under 18. This legislation will also end the sale of tobacco products from self-service vending machines. Our political correspondent, Micheál Lehan.
Today's move will make sweeping changes to how e-cigarettes are sold in this country. It will introduce a new licensing system for the sale of tobacco and nicotine-inhaling products. All retailers will now have to pay an annual fee for this licence, and there will be a ban on the sale of tobacco at any events organised for children. The new laws will be backed by enforcement measures including fixed penalty notices and the publication of the names of offending retailers. The Cabinet will also get an update on Brexit from the Taoiseach. It will outline the latest state of play and the continuing preparations that are underway in case of a no-deal outcome.
The Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is expected to hold on to power after a closely fought general election, in which his Liberal Party is set to lose its overall majority. Projections indicate the party will be in a position to form a minority government. Revised plans to overhaul Dublin's bus network are due to be announced today, after a record 50,000 people contributed to the first round of public consultation. It's understood that the National Transport Authority has agreed to increase the number of bus routes in the plan by 22%. Our Dublin correspondent John Kilrain.
The plan to redesign Dublin's bus services as part of the Bus Connects programme involves 7 super-frequency spine routes. They would interconnect with 11 orbital routes as well as local routes. The NTA said the plan would improve accessibility and increase the number of buses available. But residents in some areas would be required to take 2 buses to get to the city centre, and there was a huge number of objections. In the revised plan, the NTA is understood to be adding a new super-frequency spine, the H route, to allow greater connectivity to Howth, Portmarnock and Malahide. Among other changes, plans to do away with the direct bus routes to Skerries and Dunboyne are being replaced with new peak-time services to the city centre. There will also be a second round of public consultation.
Now the time is coming up to 7 minutes past eight.
RTE Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks. Working on a construction site? Stay clear of overhead wires and underground cables. For emergencies, call 1850 372 999.
Most areas dry today, apart from some light showers in the west. It will be mostly cloudy, but with some sunny spells also. Highest temperatures 10 to 13 degrees.
A letter writer in the Irish Times connects 2 of the morning's main stories. Maybe Boris Johnson should consult Timmy Dooley and Niall Collins on how to get the Brexit vote over the line, writes Colm O'Faherty from Rathgar, Dublin. The Irish Independent reports that Fianna Fáil public expenditure spokesman Barry Cowan is the latest frontbench TD to be dragged into the growing storm over so-called phantom voting. As the paper says, his vote was recorded on a Brexit law and on 2 other pieces of legislation last month, where he appeared to be absent from the chamber and other TDs sat in his seat. Last night, the Independent reports Mr. Cowan insisted that he never asked a colleague to vote for him when he was not in the chamber. The Irish Examiner's lead headline adds the name of Damien English, junior housing minister, to the controversy. The minister told the paper he was at the back of the chamber on a day last May when his voting button was pressed, but was not in his seat. He too said he had never asked anyone to vote for him when he was not present. The Times adds more names of TDs from Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin who have admitted to voting for colleagues who are in the Dáil chamber but not in their designated seats. As for votes in Westminster, the Times reports that Boris Johnson faces a nail-biting vote today as he attempts to rush legislation for his Brexit deal through Parliament at breakneck speed. Leo Varadkar's part in helping Johnson get his deal from Europe is noted in a column in The Examiner by Fergus Finlay. "I think it needs to be said loud and clear," writes Finlay. "Our Taoiseach did a great job for his country last week. His decision to fly to England and meet Boris Johnson on his own patch was a masterpiece of tactics and timing." "Varadkar has nailed Johnson to a form of Brexit that's about as good as we could expect," says Finlay. Meanwhile, from the north, the Belfast Telegraph reports Geoffrey Donaldson as warning Boris Johnson that the DUP might not return to Stormont if unionists don't get a veto on future Brexit arrangements. The Irish Daily Star's lead story is devoted to Terry Mullarney, a young Mayo woman who waived her anonymity yesterday so that her stepfather, Thomas Mullarney, could be named for the crime of having abused her for 12 years. He has been sentenced to 12 years in prison. The Irish Sun reports that a woman who claims she was raped by a well-known Irish person has turned down the offer of over €1 million to withdraw her allegation. The Irish Daily Mirror leads with a report about Jennifer Zamparelli, 2FM radio presenter, who has spoken about how she was beaten up by bullies every day in primary school in Dublin. Mary Robinson, former president and now special United Nations envoy on climate, provides the main story for the Irish Daily Mail. Asked about the Extinction Rebellion protests around the world, she said, "I hope they will be very smart about their tactics, because if they alienate the public, that will put us a step backwards." Speaking to reporters in Armenia, Mrs. Robinson said that climate protests were one way of causing disruption, but that the most effective method was through investors, asset managers and pension funds. The return of some MLAs to the Northern Assembly yesterday in an effort to prevent changes to the law on abortion provides the Irish News lead story. The paper reports that in a statement, the Northern Ireland bishops said it was deeply offensive to dismiss yesterday's sitting as a stunt. The Catholic Archbishop of Dublin, Dermot Martin, is reported in The Times, criticising the comments of some Catholic pundits. As Patsy McGarry reports, he was speaking at a mass on Sunday to mark the canonisation of John Henry Cardinal Newman in a church which the saint founded, University Church in Dublin. The Archbishop expressed astonishment at what he called the content and tone of daily messages on social media by Catholic pundits on the left and the right that are anything but kindly. He said the integrity of church teaching would never be defended by nastiness and bitterness.
Later today, the Taoiseach will issue a formal state apology to women and families affected by the controversy over cervical smear test results. Hundreds of women weren't told of an audit which showed they'd been given incorrect results. The failures first came to public attention 18 months ago following the settlement in the Vicky Phelan High Court case. She and a number of others will be in the Dáil when Leo Varadkar makes that apology. Dr. Gabriel Scally is the author of two reports into the cervical check controversy and he joins us on the line this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you think the Taoiseach will say today?
Well, I think this is quite a momentous step and quite unprecedented. One of the three things that really matter to people when things really go wrong badly in the medical system are for someone to tell the truth, tell them what went wrong and why it went wrong. Secondly, to say sorry and to really mean that and someone has some skin in the game. And the third is to say how it's going to be avoided in the future. So my reports and those, the work of others has, I think, explained very clearly what went wrong, that there was a complete failure from top to bottom in terms of the cervical screening program on this occasion, and some of these women and the relatives were treated appallingly badly. And my recommendations, which are being implemented and will change the whole nature of the screening program and make it much better and much safer for the women of Ireland, are those recommendations are going ahead. And the thing that has been missing in the middle is someone actually saying, like, we're very sorry and apologizing and really meaning it for what went wrong and the trauma that these women and their families were subjected to. So I think that's what's going to happen today. And I think that the Taoiseach, as a doctor, will feel this, I think, very, very deeply. And as a former Minister of Health, of course, he will understand exactly what went wrong and why it went wrong.
And will this apology, do you think, will it just be to the women most severely affected, or will it be broader than that?
Well, I'm sure it'll be broader than that, because the 221 and the relatives, and you know, that is a big group and a very important group. But of course, there have been other problems in the cervical screening program. It just hasn't affected them, and I would expect that it will be an apology to all of the women who've been affected, even those who've, you know, been seeking reassurance and haven't been able to get it, or have been affected by delayed smears, or been alarmed simply by the number of laboratories in America that the slides were sent to. I think it has been a very disturbing episode in healthcare, and it's right and proper that the Taoiseach, I think, is making the apology on behalf of the state for something that really didn't go very well at all.
As you said a few moments ago, your reports highlighted failings in many areas from top to bottom. Are you satisfied that your recommendations are being implemented?
Yes, I am. It'll take a little bit of time to do that, but the work has been really very, very good from HSE, and it's been, you know, it's been very pleasing to me to see some of the women and families very closely affected working so closely with HSE, and I give them great credit for doing that, and for them having praise for HSE and the efforts that have been put in. There's plenty more to do. There's a change in the primary test coming, with a HPV a virus test rather than the old traditional smear approach, and that's happening next year. So there's plenty still to do, and some of the changes are still working their way through. But things like the announcement of the National Screening Committee and membership yesterday, a great step forward, that the country has now a high-level advisory committee that will be dealing with all of the screening programs and making sure that a lot of the problems that we've seen in cervical check aren't repeated.
There was, in the aftermath of the controversy, a huge backlog in the number of women waiting for test results. Does that problem remain?
That problem has largely been dealt with, and I believe that the waiting time is down to 6 weeks now. And I think most of the effort now has to go into making this big change in the program and changing it to the HPV virus test, which is a much better way of doing it. As long as they're having pairs of eyes looking down microscopes, screening the slides, there's always room for error. And the laboratory test, which is done in a machine on the sample to detect the virus itself, is really very accurate in some respects, and will remove that one source of error. And removing error, the potential for error in the screening programs, is very important. So I am impressed with how things have been going.
Dr. Gabriel Scally, thank you indeed for taking our call this morning. And just to let you know that the families and the women affected, many will be speaking after that apology today. And Vicky Phelan told Morning Ireland in a text last night that this is an important day for those affected and their families.
MPs at Westminster are today expected to hold their first vote on Boris Johnson's withdrawal agreement bill, which gives legal effect to the Brexit deal agreed last week with the EU, including the Northern Ireland Protocol. The minority Conservative government hopes to rush through the legislation in the next 3 days, allowing Britain to leave the EU by the October 31st deadline. Yesterday, Commons Speaker John Bercow delivered a setback to that aim by refusing permission for a second so-called meaningful vote on the Brexit deal. What does all this mean for the prospects of the deal being agreed? We can talk to Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at the University of London. A very good morning, Tim. Thanks once more for taking our call this morning. Perhaps we can come to the timing of this legislation over the next number of days in just a moment. But first of all, in relation to whether there's a majority or not in the House of Commons for Mr. Johnson's agreement, how's it looking?
Well, it looks, if you look at some of the calculations that have been done over the last day or two, that there is a majority for the withdrawal agreement bill. So it's tight, but he should be able to get it through.
And it depends presumably on Labour, some Labour MPs at least, rowing in behind him.
That's right. But there is a big question as to whether, even if they vote for the second reading of the bill, which is, you know, the agreement in principle, they will vote for something called the programme motion, which will come up after that. And that decides whether Boris Johnson can get this through in just 3 or 4 days' time through the Commons, or whether he's actually going to have to take advantage of the extension that the EU can offer him.
So there's clearly a question over whether he can stick to that timetable. Presumably one of the issues for many MPs, they only saw this legislation last night. It was only published last night.
Yes, it's very unusual. This normally the legislation is published in draft sometime before and MPs can have a look at it, and then they wouldn't be asked to get something like this through the House of Commons in just 3 days. It really is, some people would say, a constitutional outrage, actually, that this is being asked of MPs. I mean, this bill itself takes over 100 pages, and there are over 100 pages of explanatory notes as well. So the idea that this bill can be subjected to proper scrutiny by MPs in just 3 days is, well, it's nonsensical.
And the Chancellor, Sajid Javid, saying that there'll be no economic analysis of what the implications of the bill might be.
No, funny that. I mean, all the independent analyses of Johnson's deal shows that it would make the UK even worse off than May's deal. UK and Changing Europe, of which I'm part of, released something last week, and it showed very clearly that there are big economic problems with this particular deal. And yet, as you say, the Treasury is saying that there is no need to do any kind of economic impact assessment, which again is extremely unusual.
What about the prospect, Tim, of amendments being tabled to the bill? Now, presumably, in relation to what was agreed with the EU27, that can't be changed. But there's this whole issue of Britain's future relationship and the terms under which that will be negotiated, and that does is very much open to amendments and to debate and discussion and change.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if MPs can't get a confirmatory referendum attached to this bill, and that doesn't look likely, some of them will try to get an amendment through which mandates the government to keep the UK in a customs union with the EU, which of course would negate the problem over the Irish border. That's clearly something that the government does not want to do, because it wants to sign its own free trade agreements, etc., etc. So if that passes, and there's a faint possibility that it might, I think we'd see the government withdraw the bill at that stage. And then there is another amendment that is worth thinking about and worth perhaps the opposition tabling, which is surrounding how long the UK and the EU will have to negotiate some kind of free trade arrangement once we've left, because at the moment that's supposed to happen by December 2020. There is a small provision perhaps for an extension to that, but some MPs see that as a trapdoor to no deal, as they say. So in other words, what we could be faced with in December 2020 is yet again the possibility that we crash out without any kind of deal with the European Union.
And on this suggestion that Mr. Johnson would pull the bill if any of these amendments pass through, pass Parliament, what would happen then? A general election would presumably loom much more into prospect.
Well, it would, but then there's a doubt about whether Boris Johnson can actually get that election. There might be a way around the Fixed Term Parliament Act, which would be for Parliament to pass a bill essentially mandating an election on a particular date. That might be a wheeze it could do, but otherwise the opposition could hold Boris Johnson in there for as long as it wants, and we may not get an election actually until the spring even then.
So not at all clear whether Britain will leave as planned on the 31st of October. In fact, perhaps that's looking less and less likely.
Well, certainly the one to watch for is the programme motion. If the programme motion goes the way the government wants it, we'll probably be leaving on the 31st. If it doesn't, I think it will be extremely difficult for that to happen.
Tim Vale, as ever, thank you very much indeed for that. That's Professor Tim Vale from the University of London at 8:25. I'll check on the business headlines this morning with Petula Martin. Petula.
Thanks, Brian. On Posts, gender pay gap in favour of men is 3.7% compared to 13.9% nationally. The company puts the pay discrepancy discrepancy down to a gender imbalance at management level. It's publishing its first gender pay gap report and action plan at the GPO today. The pressure is mounting on Boeing as new documents deepened doubts about the company's ability to return the 737 MAX jet to the skies. Shares tumbled after the Federal Aviation Administration criticised Boeing for withholding documents which highlighted pilots' concerns. New research carried out by Tourism Ireland has found the Brexit effect is seeping into continental Europe. 17% of people in Germany and 13% of people in France surveyed said they were less likely to visit Ireland because of the perceived hassle. Galway has been named the fourth best city in the world to visit in 2020 by Lonely Planet. The accolade comes as the city prepares for its year as European Capital of Culture. Taking a look at the currencies, 1 euro buys 86 pence sterling and $1 11.5 cents.
Recent wet weather is having a negative impact on the potato harvest. There are concerns that there could be shortages next year if large parts of the national crop are lost. 70% of the national potato crop remains in the ground, which spells trouble. On top of that, less than 10% of the country's winter tillage crops have been planted due to wet ground. A third of the country's potatoes are grown in the northeast, from where our agriculture and consumer affairs correspondent Fran McNulty now reports.
In a field near Navan in County Meath, the ground is muddy and wet. Double the normal rainfall levels were experienced here in August and September. It's putting pressure on farmers like Thomas McKeown.
The big problem here now is any rain that falls after this is just going to make it worse, because the ground is at saturation point. The rivers are way up around here. We have the Boyne and the Blackwater around here and very, very high.
We walk the land, which should by now be sown with winter barley.
Well, we're looking at tractor tracks. In general, we're seeing water lying anywhere the machine went or on the headlands. We're here on headlands and we're looking at, you can see potatoes here that are at the ends of drills and that weren't picked up, maybe due to a wet spot on the field, and the harvester had to lift across it.
Like there are a lot of potatoes left here. You wouldn't normally see that.
No, you wouldn't, in fairness. Like, machinery now, you can pick up most things, but as I say, conditions don't allow that this year.
This is a scene played out all over the country. Only a third of the national potato crop has so far been harvested. Thousands of acres of spuds remain in the ground. And the risk is they could stay there.
When potatoes come to maturity, if you like, they don't like sitting in wet ground. If they're sitting in wet ground, the chances are there's the potential for them to be more rots and you lose more in the field. They like our modern day potato harvesting, if you like. They get them out nice and dry, they put them in big refrigerated units and keep them perfect then for when the consumer wants them. And that's a huge deal at the moment. There could be big, big losses in fields if it continues the way it's going and if guys don't get them out.
Michael Hennessy from the farm advisory body Chagosk knows too well the weather hasn't been on the farmer's side.
Since the ploughing match, if you remember it, there was lovely fine weather, and as soon as that was over, it started to rain and hasn't stopped since. And that's the exact time when everybody's trying to get potatoes out, maize harvested, and put all the other crops back in, the winter crops back in at that stage. So it's just been extremely difficult. There's very little work done, anywhere between the lowest about maybe 5% in some counties and maybe 40% in some of the really dry counties down around the Tyke kind of direction. But for the most part, there's very little work done.
You could get lost in here very easily. 70 kilometres south in Rathangan, we walk through acres and acres of maize. I'm with tillage expert Siobhan Walsh, who works with agriland.ie.
So we're in a field of forage maize here in County Kildare, which is due to be put in a silage pit probably this week and feed dairy cows over the winter. So forage maize is a high energy feed and it's really good for producing loads of milk.
Tall stalks reach up into the autumn sun, but the ground below tells the real story.
The stalks are about 7 foot in the air, so it's a really good crop of maize, and about 75% of the maize crop has been harvested so far, and the remainder will most likely be cut this week, if not next week.
As where we stand now, we're in the midst of this field. We're thick in this dense maize, as you say, very tall, 6-7 foot high. Should this not be harvested now?
Ideally it should be, probably, yes, but it's still okay at the minute. What has stopped him is ground conditions.
Is it very serious?
Yes, it is, Fran. only about 10 to 15% of the winter cereal acreage was sowed last week, and it hasn't progressed much further this week because weather hasn't allowed. Soil moistures, you know, fields are waterlogged. Farmers cannot get into their fields. So farmers don't have the most profitable crops in the ground. So the knock-on effect next year is a reduction in income.
Back to Meath, where Thomas McKeown is facing a reality that much of the crop may remain in the ground. If that doesn't change, the shortage in supply cannot be ruled out.
What happens with these potatoes, Fran, is that they eventually, like at home in your house, if you leave your potatoes in water long enough, they start to go soft. And what happens here, they start to go soft and eventually they'll rot. They will rot. And look, sometimes you're lucky and you leave the rot in the field, it falls through the harvester, but with the year that's in it and the pressure farmers are on, they just try and get in and bring everything in and try and sort them out when they get into the sheds.
Farmer Thomas McKeown ending that report from our Agriculture and Consumer Affairs correspondent Fran McNulty. And you can see more on this issue on the RTE News website and on television reports throughout the day. And joining us is John Murray.
Good morning to you, Rachel. There was a surprise defeat for Arsenal in the English Premier League last night. They went down 1-0 to Sheffield United at Bramall Lane. 23-year-old former French under-21 international Lise Mousset scored the only goal after half an hour in United's first win at home in the league in 2 months. They move up to ninth. Good news for Mick McCarthy too. Republic of Ireland striker David McGoldrick returned from injury and played 78 minutes. So Arsenal miss a chance to go third, losing only their second game of the season. Liverpool dominate the nominations for the Ballon d'Or after 7 of Jurgen Klopp's men were included on the 30-man shortlist released last night. In all, 15 Premier League-based players were named alongside 5 times winners Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi. Manchester United have launched an investigation after a spectator was ejected from Old Trafford amid allegations of racist abuse during the game against Liverpool on Sunday. United have branded any form of racism completely unacceptable. The Champions League resumes tonight. Spurs play host to Red Star Belgrade. It's live on RTE2, while Manchester City are at home to Atalanta. And RTE commentator George Hamilton agrees that Spurs take to the field in a spot of bother.
That's putting it mildly, John, a spot of bother indeed. Having won only 3 of 12 matches in all competitions this season, it really is a strange time for Tottenham Hotspur to think that they were finalists in the Champions League not so long ago, just the end of last season, and here we are looking at another potential crisis. Though despite the Bayern setback that leaves them bottom of their group on goal difference to Olympiacos, if they win this game and they return away to Red Star in a fortnight, they'd be in good shape to qualify just as they did last year. So it's not all doom and gloom. And you know, Harry Kane seems to be coming into good form there, talisman, and he'll be the captain in the absence of Hugo Lloris. He scored 1 and provided 3 assists when England were beating Bulgaria in that game last week in Euro 2020. So Harry Kane may be the talisman who turns it in Tottenham's favour tonight. And as I say, I don't think it's all doom and gloom.
If ever there was a must-win game though, this is it tonight, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think they couldn't have better opposition for it. Red Star were once the kingpins of Europe. They won the European Cup in 1991 with names like Prosinecki, Mihailovic, Panchev and Dejan Savicevic. But of course that was when it was Yugoslavia. And the following year Yugoslavia were kicked out of the European Championship because of the war there. Since then the country has broken up and the Serbian League is not the power that the Yugoslav League once was. And Red Star, though they're the dominant team in Serbia, they're not a patch on what Red Star were back in 1991. So this is the right kind of opposition for Tottenham to have at just this time.
So Spurs to get a timely boost, do you think?
I think Spurs will get their timely boost tonight, assisted, it should be said, with the fact there'll be no Red Star fans in the stadium. They've been banned from attending tonight. That's the result of a UEFA ban after they were found guilty of racist behaviour at a qualifying tie in Helsinki. Fined €191,000 for similar problems last year. They've already been fined €122,000 by UEFA this season. So things not right with Red Star off the pitch. On the pitch, yes, they're dominant at home, but I think they're going to get their comeuppance tonight at the Lane.
And a much needed shot in the arm then for Spurs.
I would think so, and for their manager Maurizio Pochettino, who of course has a goalkeeper who comes from the same town in Argentina as he does. The goalkeeper, of course, replacing Lloris, who's Paolo Gazzaniga. The pair of them come from a place called Murphy, named after John James Murphy, a Wexford emigrant of the 1800s who went off to make his fortune in Argentina and made such an impact they named a town after him. A man from Kilran, just outside Rosslare Harbour in County Wexford.
You're a mine of information, George. Just a mention of the other match tonight involving an English club, Manchester City at home to Atalanta.
Yeah, well, of course, Manchester City, despite a few blips along the way in the Premier League and apparent uncertainty and giving everybody else hope, perhaps, I think in this context, up against a team from Serie A who are not necessarily the best of opposition from that part of the world. So I'd have to say that Manchester City, if they're not in need of a timely boost, at least they should get the kind of boost that will send them more certainly in the direction of qualification out of the group and into the knockout stages.
And coverage of the Spurs Red Star game gets underway at 7 o'clock on RTE2. In the SSE Electricity Premier Division tonight, Derry are at home to St Pat's. In Gaelic games, Clare GAA have announced that the two nominees to be the next Clare hurling manager are former Hurler of the Year and two-time All-Ireland winner Brian Lohan and Louis Mulqueen, who was in Davy Fitzgerald's backroom team in the 2013 All-Ireland success. In rugby news, referee Jaco Piper was not considered for a World Cup semi-final appointment after an inappropriate picture of him with Welsh fans appeared on social media. The picture showed South African official Piper raising his elbow to the chin of a Welsh fan, mimicking the elbow to the head that earned France lock Sebastian Vahamahina a red card against Wales on Sunday. Vahamahina has since announced his retirement from international rugby. In a statement, the governing body said World Rugby can confirm that the match officials' selection committee did not consider Jaco Piper for selection this weekend. Piper recognises that a picture of him with Wales fans, which appeared on social media after the Wales versus France quarter-final, was inappropriate and he has apologised. Welshman Nigel Owens will take charge of England against the All Blacks, with Francis Jerome Garces officiating for Wales versus South Africa. There's racing today at the Curragh. The first is off at 1 o'clock. For sports news updates during the day, you can check out the RTE News Now app and RTE.ie.
Now, it had elements of minor farce, but the issue at stake could not have been more serious. Yesterday, unionists tried but failed to reconvene the suspended Northern Ireland Assembly to block legislation handed down by Westminster decriminalising abortion and legalising same-sex marriage. The gathering, though, was ruled out of order and the MLAs sent packing. As a result, the new abortion and marriage laws took effect from midnight last night. Northern Ireland Secretary of State Julian Smith told the House of Commons that the first same-sex marriages would take place in the new year and that a legal framework for abortion services in the North will be in place next March.
A new legal framework for lawful access to abortion services in Northern Ireland will be put in place by 31st of March 2020 in line with the 2018 UN CEDAW report. I will be consulting on the new framework very soon. On same-sex marriage and opposite-sex civil partnerships, regulations are to be made no later than 13th of January 2020. There are two key areas we are going to consult on: how to allow for religious same-sex marriage ceremonies and also the issue of conversion from civil partnership to marriage and vice versa. The first civil same-sex marriages will take place on the week of Valentine's Day 2020.
Julian Smith, Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. Well, we'll discuss the abortion change in just a moment with Naomi Connor from the Alliance for Choice. But first, let's talk to Patrick Corrigan, Amnesty International's Northern Ireland Director. They're both in our Northern Ireland, in our Belfast studio. Very good morning to you both, and thanks for coming in. Patrick, first of all, what's your reaction now to this law on same-sex marriage becoming law at midnight last night?
Well, we're delighted. It's a really good news day for Northern Ireland. We've woken up in a fairer, better Northern Ireland, both in terms of access to abortion and on same-sex marriage. It's a victory for all of those people who have campaigned with us, and it's a really positive day for women, for the LGBT community, and for all of us who want to live in a fairer society. We won that through hard graft, through marching, through petitioning, through lobbying, both at Stormont and ultimately at Westminster, where we ultimately won our two campaigns.
Attempts to get the measure through Stormont had failed because of DUP opposition. They're able to use this mechanism called a petition of concern. The fact that it had to come from Westminster, what do you make of that?
Well, it does show the dysfunctionality of the Stormont political institutions, that for very many years, ever since polling began on this issue in Northern Ireland, we had huge popular support for same-sex marriage. But Stormont was never able to deliver, and even when a majority of Assembly members voted in favour of it in November 2015, they still couldn't legislate because the DUP popped up with a petition of concern, this minority veto, which a card they were able to play, and would still be able to play if Stormont was back tomorrow. So when the institutions did collapse in January 2017, we took our campaign to Westminster. We worked with backbench MPs and peers right across both Houses of Parliament. We didn't have to win the substantive argument there on same-sex marriage or abortion, because those debates had been had and won years ago in the rest of the UK, and we simply then had to wait for the right legislative vehicle which we could bring amendments to, and we did that in July with the Northern Ireland Executive Formation Act. So yes, we would have preferred to win this at Stormont, and in fact we did win a majority of Assembly members at Stormont, but still it couldn't deliver.
I mean, I suppose there's been a lot of discussion in the context of Brexit about the necessity for cross-community support embedded in the Good Friday Agreement, and does bringing in a change like this in this way at all contribute to undermining those fundamental principles of the political settlement in the North?
You know, I think that the whole idea of cross-community consent, that was about making sure that minority rights in Northern Ireland were not trampled over in the political institutions in the way that I think the nationalist Republican community would say that the Stormont of old, the Stormont up to the early 1970s did, and the petition of concern and the other cross-community consent mechanisms were in place for that reason. What they came to be, however, was actually a veto on minority human rights, and that means that for Stormont to return and for it to actually represent a government for all of the people of Northern Ireland, it will need to be heavily reformed. And I think that the farce, the charade in Stormont Assembly Chamber yesterday underlines that point. I don't think that was a day that anybody could be proud of, whether they want to see Stormont back or not.
The Secretary of State is promising legislation to allow for the first marriages to take place around St. Valentine's Day in February. But there's other legislation needed as well, won't there be, in terms of the rights of same-sex couples? We were discussing on this programme the issue in relation to parental rights in this jurisdiction. So those are issues that will need to be addressed as well, will they?
Well, there are a number of issues, but same-sex couples are already able to adopt in Northern Ireland, so those issues are largely addressed. I think a couple of the outstanding issues, and that was mentioned by Julian Smith at the end of the excerpt you played, and that we're still in discussion with government on. One is about the ability of same-sex couples of religious belief to be able to have religious ceremonies as part of their marriages, and that's not quite over the line yet, and that does not appear to be going to be delivered at the beginning of the year. And also, the very many couples here in the absence of same-sex marriage being available to them who instead went for civil partnerships, we want them to be able to convert straight away to full marriage recognition. And again, the government, for reasons that are unfathomable to us at the moment, and we're in discussion with the government on this, the government is saying that also will not be delivered in the early new year. Right. So there are still some outstanding issues, but for most couples who want to get married, they will be able to do so, and they will be able to do so, as Julian Smith said, in the week of Valentine's Day 2020. That's a great reason for celebration.
All right, well, Patrick Corrigan of Amnesty, thank you for that. With you there in Belfast is Naomi Connor, as I said, from the Alliance for Choice. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning.
The decriminalisation as of midnight last night of abortion in Northern Ireland. What's that going to mean for the provision in the future of abortion services in the North?
Well, what I have to say first of all is that I went to bed last night before midnight. It was an exhilarating day for human rights in Northern Ireland, but I woke up this morning safe in the knowledge that I and many women like me are no longer potential criminals. So in terms of the decriminalisation, what it means is Sections 58 and 59 of the Offences Against a Person Act, which were used and abused to govern women's bodies, will be repealed. So what that means is women who are seeking abortion will no longer be considered potential criminals if they choose to access rights over their own body. What it doesn't mean is that service provision and destigmatisation will come. So in the next number of weeks, we're expecting a consultation period to ensue, and we will start to see how abortion provision is going to be shaped in Northern Ireland. Not if it's going to be provided, but how that's going to be done.
But at the moment, and until new legislation is put in place by the end of March, as promised by Julian Smith, there is, it is true to say, is it not, that there's a largely unregulated environment in relation to terminations
No, that's simply not the case. And we've heard this lauded from, you know, anti-choice organisations and, in my view, irresponsibly from Baroness O'Loan. There is regulation provision in abortion under the General Medical Council's guidelines, and abortions happen in Northern Ireland. 12 abortions were carried out last year. 12 to 13 abortions are carried out each year under the extremely limited circumstances that abortion can take place in Northern Ireland. So that provision and those guidelines are there already. And what I have to say is, you know, what we know about unsafe abortions in places like, you know, Latin America and Africa and Asia is that 25 million women a year die from unsafe abortion because it's not legislated for and it's not provided for. So the very people who are saying there's going to be unregulated abortions and a free-for-all want that situation to prevail all the time.
But you mentioned Baroness O'Loan and what she told us on the programme earlier, and she stands by this claim that it would allow terminations up to 28 weeks, and that's based on this 1943 Criminal Justice Act, which outlaws the abortion of a viable baby, but presumes viability is after 28 weeks.
Yeah. Well, the actual term in the legislation is prima facie, and what that means is until other evidence is presented. So the likelihood is that it will be 24 weeks because, you know, of medical advances and so forth. But irrespective of when a woman, you know, decides to terminate a pregnancy, that has to be a choice between her and her medical professionals, you know, that she's dealing with at that time. This is about the right to choose. It's not about forced abortions. You know, we don't go around as activists, and I'm one of those women who has travelled as well. And that, you know, I heard people saying yesterday that you chose to travel. I didn't choose to travel to have an abortion. I was forced to travel. Mm. And even until March 2020, the reality is the majority of women in Northern Ireland who are seeking terminations will continue to be forced to travel to England to seek those services.
All right, well, there we leave it. Thank you indeed for talking to us on the programme this morning. Both Naomi Connor and Patrick Corrigan. The time here on Maureen Ireland is just 7 minutes to nine.
Well, as we heard a little earlier, Boris Johnson will today begin another bid to secure Britain's departure from the EU by the end of the month. In Strasbourg, meanwhile, the European Council President Donald Tusk has been speaking to the European Parliament. He said they were preparing for all Brexit scenarios.
The situation is quite complex following events over the weekend in the UK and the British request for an extension of the Article 50 process. I am consulting the leaders on how to react and will decide in the coming days. It is obvious that the result of these consultations will very much depend on what the British Parliament decides or doesn't decide. We should be ready for every scenario. But one thing must be clear. As I said to Prime Minister Johnson on Saturday, a no-deal Brexit will never be our decision.
Donald Tusk, the President of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, has also been speaking to the Parliament. Here's a little of what he had to say.
In many of these 105 debates, I had to discuss the UK's departure from the European Union with you. In truth, it has pained me to spend so much of this mandate dealing with Brexit, when I have thought of nothing less than how this union could do better for its citizens. Waste of time and waste of energy. The Commission has worked tirelessly to renegotiate an agreement with the United Kingdom to respect the UK's decision to leave the European Union.
A waste of time and a waste of energy, Jean-Claude Juncker there. Mary Regan of our political staff is in Strasbourg and has been following proceedings. Mary, is this the last time that these two men will address the Parliament?
Yes, this is expected to be their last presentation before the Parliament of their term in office. And as you heard there, Jean-Claude Juncker being very strong in his words that he regrets very much having to spend so much of his mandate dealing with the single issue of Brexit. Now, both men did say that the European Parliament, while some MEPs had arrived here in Strasbourg yesterday evening expecting that maybe they might get a chance to vote on the Brexit deal because it has to be ratified by this Parliament, both men said that there will be no ratification because they were pointing out that the Parliament will only vote on it at a point where it can't be modified or changed any further by the Parliament in Westminster. So it does have to come to this Parliament, and time for that, of course, is running out because the Parliament, European Parliament, is not due to sit next week. They have something called a constituency week, and many of them will be away on delegation visits. So some MEPs around here are saying they won't be able to be called back for an emergency session next week, meaning that it's unlikely the deal, even if it gets through Westminster, will be passed here before October 31st.
How much did the two men say about what's happening in Britain this week? Because it's still all as clear as mud.
Yeah, well, the sense really is that the ball is very much in the UK's court at this point. So it's a sort of stand back and watch from here approach that they're taking. But they did use the opportunity to state very strongly their regret at the decision to leave by the UK to leave the European Union, as if they haven't said it enough times before. But they made sure to put it on the record for their last appearance here in the Parliament. Another thing being raised here is that Jean-Claude Juncker was pointing out to MEPs that the deal that's currently there does address all the concerns of the European Parliament. And the reason he was stating that very strongly is because some MEPs around here have been maybe flexing their muscles a little bit, pointing out that it will have to go through a formal ratification. And they're saying if the British Parliament has all this time to discuss and analyse and debate the agreement, so too should the European Parliament have all the time to discuss it and analyse it. And Manfred Weber, who's the chair of the EPP grouping here, he was pointing out that this will not be a technical assessment that we do here in the European Parliament. It will be a full and a political assessment. So this won't be over yet, and the European Parliament will want to have their final say on it.
Mary, thanks indeed. Mary Regan there of our political staff reporting from Strasbourg.